Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. We're fortunate to have a special guest host, Jay Garfinkel, with us today. Hi, Jay.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Nice to be here.
We are honored to welcome Emmanuel Navon to the podcast to talk about his new book, The Star and the Scepter, A Diplomatic History of Israel. Emmanuel Navon is an international relations expert who has published dozens of articles and books, including From Israel with Hope and The Victory of Zionism, Reclaiming the Narrative about Israel's Domestic, Regional, and International Challenge. Emmanuel Navon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. Why do you think diplomacy is still important in this age of instant communications and direct conversation?
Because it needs to be handled by professionals. I think we see it today. We see the main issues of international relations today, whether it is Iran's nuclear program or the very complicated relations between the United States and China. This cannot be handled on social media or WhatsApp. I think the social media create the false impression that you no longer need professional diplomacy among states, but this is a mistake. We still need professionals to handle the very complicated relations between states that are often rivals, and this cannot be handled with direct communication only among heads of states, and definitely not on social media.
Why did you start the book with a chapter on the Hebrew Bible? That was a surprise.
Yes, because I think it would be impossible, in my opinion, to understand how the Jews perceive themselves and their relation with other nations without understanding the document which is at the end at the core of Jewish identity and self-perceived historical role. I think the Hebrew Bible continues to shape the way Jews see themselves, and one cannot understand expressions such as a people that dwells alone, or the struggle against Amalek, or even the concept of Messiah without understanding the Hebrew Bible. So I thought that the first thing to do when writing a book about the diplomatic history of Israel and of the Jewish people was to take a look into what the Bible has to say about the relation between the Jews and the nations.
Can you give us a small example of one of the diplomatic challenges faced by the biblical Israelites?
So there are many examples that I give in my book, both in the Torah, in the Pentateuch, but also in the prophets. I think among the examples that I give in my book is that of the prophet Jeremiah, which faced one of the worst diplomatic crises of his time. Before the destruction of the first temple in the 6th century, before the Common Era. And Jeremiah handles very complicated issues of political realism versus faith. Is the acceptation of fate an act of faith or the opposite? And I think that Jeremiah had to face this very complicated question, which you can see repeating itself throughout Jewish history. What should the Jews do when conquered by a foreign nation? Now, what's interesting in the, I would say, the theology of Jeremiah is that instead of the classical dichotomy between faith and political realism, he, in fact, creates a unique theology which claims at the time that accepting fate and accepting and bowing to political realism is in fact an act of faith, because he claims, of course, that the Jewish people is being punished for not being faithful to the Sinai Convent and therefore should accept the conquest of Jerusalem until it deserves to be independent again. And I think this message this controversial message is probably key also to understand the survival of the Jewish people throughout history since antiquity. This unique survival might be explained by the fact that historically the Jews always perceived their drawbacks and their historical defeats as a well-deserved punishment for their misbehavior, which was supposed to be followed by redemption and a better future. And I think that this unique eschatology is probably key to understanding Jewish survival, which is also another reason why I thought it was necessary to look into the Hebrew Bible in order to understand the Jewish mentality and how Jews have been handling their relations with other nations throughout history.
All right, that sets us up very clearly for what follows if we just fast forward from biblical times to the 19th century. As you just said, certain ideas achieve prominence at certain times in history, as the one Jeremiah promulgated. What do you think encouraged the idea of Jewish national renaissance in the 19th century?
So there are many causes, but of course, I think that ultimately the feeling that both the promises, which I explained in my book, both the promises of the of messianism and the Enlightenment failed to deliver. The fact that you had many self-proclaimed messiahs in the 16th and 17th century, the most famous one, of course, being Shabtai Tzvi, and that this promise of a messiah would just show up and redeem the Jewish people really turned to be a flop after the Sabbatai Tzvi embarrassment. But I think also the fact that the Enlightenment itself did not deliver in the sense, of course, the Enlightenment delivered in terms of granting Jews in Western countries equal civil rights. But it did not deliver in the fact that, especially in France, Jews were presented with some kind of an unwritten contract, which is that they would renounce the national aspect of their identity, only keep the religious one, and become part of the French nation. This kind of demand was made very clearly both during the debate at the French National Assembly by a French member of the parliament, Stanislas de Clermont-Tonnerre, who famously said the Jews should be granted everything as individuals and nothing as a nation or as a people. This demand was also made by Napoleon Bonaparte when he convened the Grand Sanhedrin, the Great Sanhedrin, in 1806 to basically demand from France's top rabbis to make it very clear that the Jews had ceased to be a nation and were only now a religion, and that Paris was the new Jerusalem. Now, most Jews went along. They accepted that deal. And that deal was broken basically with the Dreyfus Affair, because Alfred Dreyfus had embraced the French nation. He had even become an officer in the French army, and yet he was wrongly accused as a Jew. And even though the Jews had fulfilled their part of the contract, of this unwritten contract, it was broken by the French Third Republic, the most liberal and enlightened regime in Western Europe at the time. And I think that's what brought to the Herzl to come to the conclusion that if the Enlightenment did not keep its promises, then the Jews had to become a nation again, like everybody else. And it is not a coincidence that he wrote Der Judenstaat, of all places, in Paris.
Emmanuel, let's turn to the 20th century. Great Britain had not yet won the First World War and occupied the Ottoman territory in the Middle East, and yet it issued a very interesting but strange diplomatic declaration, not to another nation, but to a people, of its intention to create a homeland for the Jewish people. What's the historical and diplomatic significance of the Balfour Declaration?
So if I explain in my book that if the Balfour Declaration was published today, it would be decried on the social media as anti-Semitic. Why am I saying this? Because Balfour himself said, we need to issue this document in order to make sure that Russia stays in the war and that America joins it. We're talking about 1917. The First World War has been raging for 3 years. Russia is collapsing economically, about to leave, to abandon the Eastern Front and to quit the war. It's not clear yet if the United States is going to join. And Balfour is saying basically that, you know, we all know the influence of the Jews in Moscow and Washington, this old myth that, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, they're so influential, right, in those two capitals. And he also claims, wrongly, by the way, that most Jews are Zionists, which was far from being the case. And he says very clearly we need to issue this declaration in order to make sure that the Jews convince both Moscow to stay in the war and Washington to join. So it was very clearly a document meant to buy the goodwill of the Jews, attributing to them formidable powers, which of course they didn't have, definitely not in Russia, where they were oppressed and were not, didn't enjoy the basic rights that Jews enjoyed in Western Europe. And both Britain and France were fighting over the Middle East, by the way. Balfour not only issued his declaration because he thought that this would convince Russia to stay in the war and Washington to join it, but also because he was competing against France about the Middle East. And he said, there's no way we're going to let France, which is a secular republic, a secular and an atheist republic, rule over the Holy Land. And the fact that you know, England was an Anglican country, that the head of state is both, as we know, head of the Anglican Church, it's also one of the reasons why the British decided to issue the Balfour Declaration to claim property over the Holy Land and not let it in the hands of what it called at the time secular and agnostic France.
One of the interesting points your book makes is that diplomacy, its success and failure, occur when the unexpected happens. I thought that was a very interesting insight you had. One of the examples you give is an unexpected ally, Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, who voted, strangely, to establish the State of Israel. What was the calculation behind his UN vote of 1947?
So Joseph Stalin was very clearly a man of realpolitik and political realism. He was not an ideologue. He had no problem signing an agreement with Hitler, the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact in August 1939, and then ally himself with the West against Germany. And during the war, by the way, after Germany invaded the Soviet Union, his speeches were very, firstly, nationalist. He spoke in the name of the great nation of Russian history. He even referred to figures of the Russian Orthodox Church, and this was the leader of the Russian Communist Party, right? So my point here is that Stalin handled Russia's foreign policy in a very realistic and even cynical manner, and this is also how he handled Zionism. Zionism was incompatible with Marxism and socialism, because both Zionism and Marxism-Leninism offered two competing solutions, so to speak, to what was called at the time, quote-unquote, the Jewish problem or the Jewish question. The solution of Zionism was nationalism, that the Jews should be able to build a nation state like everybody else. The solution, so to speak, of socialism was that eventually Marxism was going to erase national and religious identities, and therefore in the final struggle of the classes, between the classes, nationalities and religions would anyways be erased, and the Jews would be part of it. So obviously, since the Soviet Union was home to about 3 million Jews, the idea of Jewish nationalism came into competition with socialism in Russia. So ideologically, Joseph Stalin had absolutely no reason in the world for supporting a national movement that undermined the very ideology of the Soviet Union. And then he supported it because, as I said, he was first and foremost a man of realpolitik. And his main objective as we know today from the archives from the Soviet Union, was to drive out Great Britain from the Middle East. And for him, voting in favor of partition of British Palestine at the UN, recognizing Israel and even arming Israel via Czechoslovakia in 1948, was necessary to help drive out the British from the Middle East. And his support for Israel, of course, did not last for very long, but it served his interest in 48 to help and drive out the British from a region in which he had ambitions, like everywhere else in the world, the Soviet Union being, in essence, an imperialistic power.
And speaking of partition, why do you believe that the Arab rejection of partition, or any compromise at all, actually helped the Zionist cause?
Because it was perceived as unreasonable at the UN and in the European chancelleries. I mean, the Arabs had just been granted many new states and kingdoms throughout the Middle East. Don't forget that at the time, back then, the Arabs were perceived as one nation. It just happened that this nation was divided into different mandates that had been established by the British and the French after World War I. And this Arab nation had been granted Syria, Lebanon, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, but also Iraq, Saudi Arabia. And the idea that in that region, the Jews would not be allowed to be granted any territory whatsoever seemed completely unreasonable. And it actually confirmed the position of many at the UN that if the Arabs were being so inflexible about recognizing any right of the Jews to national self-determination anywhere, that actually made the case of the Jews and of the Zionists even stronger.
Diplomacy makes very strange bedfellows. I wanted to follow up with the chapter you wrote about the Suez Canal, where Britain, the former occupying power of Mandate Palestine, France, which became a friend at the beginning of the state, and Israel all became allies in the 1956 Suez War against Egypt over the nationalization of the Suez Canal. But opposed to Israel, interestingly, was the American president, Eisenhower, who threatened Israel's very existence if they wouldn't withdraw back to its lines. Would it be fair to say, and I'm trying to think of this as being fair to Eisenhower, that he was the first in a successive line of American presidents whose foreign policy interests were aligned with Arab states?
So Eisenhower came to power in 1953, determined to stop Soviet influence in the world in general, in the Middle East in particular. He had a policy of containment vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. This was the height of the Cold War. And his outlook and that of and the outlook of many of his advisors and also of his Secretary of State at the time, John Foster Dulles, was that it was really important for the United States to make sure that no Arab countries would be pushed into the arms of the Soviet Union. And as far as the Middle East was concerned, that meant convincing the Arab world that the United States really had nothing to do with Israel, which at the time was true, by the way. But the very fact that his predecessor, President Harry Truman, had recognized Israel in 1948 was considered by many in the State Department as a step that had alienated the Arab states. In fact, Truman had made this decision against the stance, the position of most of the establishment in Washington, D.C., especially the State Department. So the Eisenhower administration went out of its way to convince the Arab world that the U.S. had nothing to do with Israel, and indeed there was a U.S. embargo, a military embargo on Israel. His purpose at the time, as I said, was not to lose more Arab states to the Soviet Union. So I wouldn't say necessarily that he was the first Arab U.S. president who had a pro-Arab policy. He just conducted U.S. Foreign policy based on what he perceived as the U.S. national interest. And in the mid-1950s, as far as he was concerned, that meant making sure that no countries would cross the lines towards the Soviet Union. And in the Middle East, the only way to do this, in his view, was to convince the Arab world that the U.S. really had nothing to do with Israel.
Actually, that was a failure because Egypt was very much aligned with Russia. But I want to skip ahead for a second. Your book revealed something which I had never heard or read before, and that was interesting to me, that the Iran-Israel connection existed post-Islamic Revolution in 1979. Israel, you say, was selling weapons to Iran to help them defeat Iraq. What happened that turned useful, if albeit a secret relationship, into one of their ambition to wipe Israel off the map?
So when Iran became an Islamic Republic in 1979, it was first a huge blow to Israel because before the Islamic Revolution, Iran and Israel had been allies, no less than allies. Iran was the biggest supplier of oil, Israel's biggest supplier of oil. Part of the Iranian army and the personal guard of the Shah was owned by Israel. You had direct flights between Tehran and Tel Aviv and the whole Israeli community in Tehran. So obviously, in that sense, the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a huge blow, which led to the cancellation and to the end of diplomatic relations between the two countries. And yet, despite the rhetoric of the new Iranian regime of the U.S. being the great Satan and Israel the small Satan, at the end of the day, behind this rhetoric, there was also a war between Iraq and Iran that erupted in 1980. And as we remember, Menachem Begin, Israel's prime minister, had quipped at the time regarding this war between Iran and Iraq, quote unquote, "I wish the best of luck to both sides." But the truth of the matter is that Israel actually wished better luck to Iran secretly. Why? Because first of all, nobody at the time really knew what the Islamic regime would look like. Don't forget that both the United States and France had allowed Khomeini to fly back to Tehran, and they didn't expect his regime to turn into a radical Islamic republic. And as far as Israel was concerned, it's not only because Israel was unsure about what the Iranian regime would look like, but for Israel, the biggest military threat was Iraq, the biggest army in the Middle East, which had taken part to wars between Israel in the past. And therefore, Israel continued to have a quiet military relationship with Iran during the war with Iraq. And that secret relation was revealed, in fact, with the Iran-Contra scandal in 1986. It did end eventually with the end of the war between Iran and Iraq when in 1988, but also because after the war with Iraq, Iran renewed its nuclear program, which had been suspended during the war with Iraq, and upgraded its not only its rhetoric against Israel, but also its actions against Israel, such as the terrorist activities against Israelis and Jews around the world, one of the most famous being, of course, the bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in 1994.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Secrecy seems to be more the rule than the exception in the world of diplomacy, Emmanuel. In the 1990s, there were also secret talks, a back channel, and unofficial talks that resulted in the Oslo Accords and the ultimately very disappointing and bloody peace process. Why did that process fail to make peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, I claim in my book that the underlying reason was that there was a quid pro quo between Israel and the PLO. The PLO had gained some kind of recognition from the United States in the late 1980s, especially with the outbreak of the First Intifada in December of 1987, and the dramatic decision of King Hussein to disconnect himself from the West Bank. Don't forget that the West Bank had been annexed by Jordan in 1950, and the salaries were still paid by the Hashemite Kingdom. And in 1988, by fear that the Intifada would spread from the West Bank to his kingdom, King Hussein basically had declared that he would sever any ties with the West Bank, which created a political void in the historical struggle between the King of Jordan and Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, which had been going on for decades. And so this created, as I said, a political void. So Arafat did gain some kind of legitimacy in Washington, D.C., especially after he declared in an ambiguous manner that he was willing to recognize Israel and the UN Security Council Resolution 242. And a dialogue started between Arafat and Washington. But then Arafat shot himself in the foot with the first Gulf War in 1991 by supporting Saddam Hussein. So not only was he written off by the U.S., but he also lost his major source of funding from the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, which had been threatened themselves by Saddam Hussein. And so he found himself economically bankrupt and politically isolated in Tunis. And don't forget that in addition, because of the Madrid peace process, many countries were now recognizing Israel, establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. You also had the massive immigration of Soviet Jews to Israel. And so Arafat realized that the clock was ticking against him. And so when the peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians didn't go anywhere in the framework of the Madrid peace process, which had been moved to Washington, and secret talks and a secret channel had been opened between Israeli academics and the PLO in Oslo, Arafat showed himself extremely flexible in this secret channel because he had nothing to lose. He had nothing to lose. He was willing to sign anything that Israel presented to him, and he did. But the problem is that he didn't do it as Dennis Rose would let her write. This was not a transformation, it was a transaction. In other words, Arafat only signed an agreement to salvage himself from diplomatic isolation and economic bankruptcy, but with no intention whatsoever of actually reaching a historical agreement with Israel. And he actually said so himself in a recorded speech he didn't know was recorded in Johannesburg in June 1994, where he compared the Oslo agreements to the Pact of Hudaybiyah between the Prophet Muhammad and the Hudaybiyah people in Mecca in the 7th century, which was a temporary agreement signed in a position of weakness only to be ripped and then violated to defeat the enemy. And he said so very clearly. And so when time came for making actual compromise and decisions, he basically dithered and refused to make historical compromises. So it doesn't mean, of course, that Israel was faultless during the Oslo process, but I do claim very clearly in my book that at the end of the day, Arafat made a tactical decision to save himself in 1993 with no intention whatsoever of reaching an actual historical compromise with Israel.
It's a very religious region of the world. What role do you think religion does and should play in diplomacy?
So first of all, it does play a role because, as you said yourself, the Middle East is a religious region. But I think that precisely because most people, many people in the Middle East are religious, it's important to, first of all, to recognize this fact, to understand it, to also understand the theological divide between the Shias and the Sunnis among Muslims. The difference, of course, in a country such as Lebanon between the different sects and the Christians and the Muslims. But it's also, I think, important to speak the actual language of religion. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that for many years, and we saw it during the Oslo process, religion was manipulated by some to try and deny the very rights of others. Arafat, whom we just spoke about, did this a lot, claiming, for example, during the Camp David summit, that there had never been a Jewish temple in Jerusalem, and therefore that the Jews shouldn't have any rights over the Temple Mount. But this was a manipulation because historically, in fact, Islam always recognized the connection of the Jews to Jerusalem, starting with the very name, original name of Jerusalem in Arabic, Bayt al-Maqdis, which is the Arabic transliteration of Bet Amikdash, the temple in Hebrew. Or the fact that I show this in my book, prospects from the Waqf in the 1920s under the British mandate, described for tourists the Temple Mount as being the former site of the Temple of Solomon. So I show in my book that traditionally Islam and the Arabs used to recognize the historical connection between the Jews and Jerusalem, which was only denied recently by the PLO, the ultimate example being, of course, Arafat denying the very existence of a temple at the Camp David summit. And what we do see today, in fact, was the Abraham Accords, for example, which are called Abraham Accords for a reason, is a recognition among many Muslims of going back to the actual sources of Islam and recognizing that the Jews are part of the region, that they have a historical connection to it. It doesn't mean that we're going to agree on everything, but I mean that precisely because the Middle East, as you said correctly, is a very religious region, it is important to be faithful to what text and tradition actually have to say and not manipulate them for political purposes.
I wanted you to share your insights, if you would, of after reading the whole book, but wanted you to speculate or to frame for the audience what happens when the prime minister is also a foreign minister, for example, under Bibi Netanyahu. How does that shape Israelis' diplomatic initiatives?
Well, first of all, the fact that Netanyahu held a foreign ministry portfolio for about 4 years was just a confirmation of Henry Kissinger's famous statement that Israel does not have a foreign policy, only has domestic politics. It was only for domestic politics, for reasons of domestic politics, that Netanyahu decided to hold on the foreign ministry portfolio. And I think that in that case, even though Netanyahu in many ways was very successful in foreign policy, especially in achieving the Abraham Accords and in strengthening Israel's relation with Africa, Latin America, and coordinating Israel's move in Syria with Russia. But on the other hand, the fact that he weakened the foreign ministry, in my opinion, was a mistake because he ended up handling Israel's foreign relations almost exclusively with the National Security Council and the Mossad, cutting down on the foreign ministry. And I think this was a mistake because at the end of the day, in order to implement a successful foreign policy, it's not enough to have photo ops and a foreign minister or prime minister traveling around the world. You also need on the ground a whole infrastructure to turn vision into actual policy. And you need the foreign ministry to have the means to implement its policy, and this wasn't the case in the past few years. So, as I said, I think it's better to have a foreign minister having a full-time job. I think being a prime minister of Israel is really a full-time job, and letting the foreign minister handle Israel's foreign policy with the very professional diplomats that Israel's foreign ministry has.
Well, I agree with you. Being prime minister is more than a full-time job. Finally, Emmanuel, what are the biggest diplomatic challenges facing Israel today?
So I think that if we look today, besides Israel's diplomatic achievements and successes in recent years, one of the main challenges today is, of course, we're all aware of it, the Iranian challenge and how to handle a country obsessed with Israel for ideological and theological reasons. And I think just today or yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed the fact that the U.S. no longer expected to sign an agreement with a new agreement with Iran. So that is definitely a major security threat for Israel. But on the other hand, Israel has a strong enough relation with the United States, I think, to handle Iran, but it has to be handled very, very carefully because, of course, the problem of nuclear deterrence with a country such as Iran is that Iran is a theocracy and it is ruled by clerics, some of which believe in the tradition of Shia Islam that the 12th Imam would only show up when the Jews are erased from the map of the earth. So that is definitely a big challenge. Another challenge is, of course, the fact that even though, as I explained in my book, eventually Israel had the upper hand in its conflict with the Arab world, at the end of the day, the Palestinian issue is not going anywhere, and Israel will have to make choices. None of those are easy. But as I said, even though Israel eventually gained the upper hand in the Arab-Israeli conflict, Palestinian issue has not disappeared and will not disappear. And that is also a major challenge for Israel, how to handle this issue, which decisions to make in the future. There's also, of course, the declining support of the Jewish diaspora in the United States, the fact that there were always, as I show in my book, strong disagreements between Israel, even before independence, and the American Jewish diaspora. But in recent years, this relationship has become more and more complicated, with a weakening support from many American Jews, especially liberal American Jews, which is many of them declaring themselves in recent years or recent months being no longer Zionist at all. So that is definitely also a challenge. Is Israel giving up on American Jewry and only building its political support in America on the Evangelists and the Republican Party or not? That is a challenge. And finally, I think also, and we've seen it in recent years, a very complicated relation with China. As the global confrontation between the United States and China is increasing, more and more the U.S. is asking Israel and even sometimes demanding from Israel to seriously cut down on Chinese investments in Israel. And more Israel has to take sides in this global confrontation between the U.S. And China. And that is a challenge because China is being more and more supportive of Iran. It signed an agreement with Iran a few months ago, granting China preferential access to the Iranian economy and infrastructures. And so I think as the global confrontation between the United States and China intensifies, this also will be a big challenge for Israel's foreign policy.
You've written an important book, Emmanuel, one that helps clarify the very complicated chessboard of Israeli diplomacy. I hope it'll be widely read. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hosting me.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.